we have an increase among our 10th, 11th grade girls in areas of suicidal ideations and depression.
A new federal grant could help the state reduce the high teen suicide rate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 15th of October. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, Governor Palin's rural advisor explains her resignation.
I think you do have to have a native Alaskan in the position, especially now.
Those stories and much more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center opening celebration is October 18th and 19th, featuring big, wild events. Beginning at 10 a.m., free activities for the whole family include live entertainment, an oxygen and octane expo, a street fair along F Street showcasing the new Anchorage Convention District, and Warren Miller Films at the Egan Center. Event information is available online at anchorage.net. This message is sponsored by the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Witnesses for Senator Ted Stevens contradicted the testimony of Bill Allen today. Stevens is on trial in Washington, D.C. for charges of lying on his financial disclosure forms about more than $250,000 in gifts, mostly from oil field services company Vico and Allen, who was its CEO. Earlier in the trial, Allen served as the government's key witness. But as APRN's Libby Casey reports, the latest defense witnesses are telling a different story.
Ted's just covering his ass. That's what Bob Person said, at least according to government witness Bill Allen. Persons and Allen helped Senator Ted Stevens with the renovation of his Girdwood home. Stevens asked Allen for construction invoices, but Allen never billed him. Allen testified earlier in the trial that was because their mutual friend, Persons, said Stevens didn't really want to bill and was just protecting himself. But Wednesday, jurors heard directly from Bob Persons. The Girdwood restaurant owner lives near the Stevens Alaskan home and is good friends with the couple. When a defense lawyer asked Persons if he'd ever said that Ted was just covering his ass, Persons laughed and said, "No, that's crazy." The defense is trying to pin the blame on Allen and say he was the one manipulating bills and lying. The jury heard Persons' voice last week when government prosecutors played wiretapped phone calls between him and Bill Allen. In one of the calls, they schemed to cover up a bill Allen paid for Stevens. Persons testified Wednesday that Allen was trying to hide the bill from the senator. In another recorded conversation, Persons said, quote, "Catherine says Ted gets hysterical when he has to spend his own money." On Wednesday, Persons blew that off by saying it was just a joke. He took a happy-go-lucky demeanor during the start of his testimony, but his grin faded during cross-examination. Prosecutor Nicholas Marsh showed that Persons was contradicting his past statements to a grand jury and emails he'd sent. Persons claimed to have a very poor memory and at one point said he didn't recall a document he'd been talking about a half hour earlier. One example of Persons' contradictory statements was about extravagant Christmas lights the government says Vico gave Stevens as a gift. Persons told a grand jury that he'd never seen them on and that the Stevens couple hated them. But in emails sent in December 2002 and 2003, he tells Senator Stevens about getting the lights repaired by a worker for Vico and tells Stevens, quote, "The guys put some great Christmas lights out." So who were the guys? The prosecution asked. Persons claimed he didn't know who he'd meant and couldn't say if they were Vico guys. Persons did admit to buying Stevens one gift himself, a $2,700 massage chair, which he had shipped to Stevens' Washington home. But Persons said Stevens told him he could not accept the gift, so instead, Persons made it a loan. The chair stayed at Stevens' house. Persons wasn't the only witness Wednesday who contradicted what jurors have heard. Contractor Augie Payone testified about working on the Stevens house and said Bill Allen told him to, quote, "eat the bill." That counters what Allen said. Payone testified that when he worked at the Stevens house during 2000 and 2001, he was told to send invoices to Allen, who would then forward them to the senator's wife, Catherine. Payone said he was paid promptly for five bills, but not the sixth and final one. Payone testified that when Allen told him to eat the bill or see it as a political contribution, he was shocked. Payone said he never approached the Stevens couple about payment because he thought it would be, quote, business suicide. He was afraid of retribution from the huge and wealthy Vico Corporation. Payon was eventually paid a year later by Allen, who rolled the missing $13,000 into payment for a separate project. But Payon said despite all that, he went back to the Stevens home in 2002 to do additional work paid for by Allen. The prosecutor asked if people at the house would have noticed what he'd done, and Payon said yes. Government prosecutors are trying to show that Stevens should have known he hadn't fully paid for the renovation. Payon testified that 2 years ago, he told a grand jury he was concerned a problem would arise from the remodeling project because of all the Vico employees working at the job site. He estimated Vico sunk $100,000 into the project. Payon said Wednesday he thought Vico might have gone through that large sum quickly because the project was not being run correctly. That gives credence to the defense attorney's stance that Stevens did not know how much Vico was putting into the project because he and his wife believe their total payment of $160,000 to legitimate contractors should have covered everything. When the trial resumes Thursday, Bob Persons will go back on the stand to conclude his testimony. Then there are just two more planned defense witnesses, Catherine and Ted Stevens. They don't have to testify, and until they're standing in the witness box raising their right hand, it's a mystery if they really will. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
President Bush today signed a bill banning the export of mercury, a dangerous neurotoxin especially hazardous to children and women. The bill was sponsored by Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski and Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama and several others. Senator Murkowski says mercury, even at small levels, can be very dangerous and it needs better control.
Once mercury is burned and introduced into the air, it can contaminate the oceans, the lakes, the rivers. We know how it can travel up the food chain, or just the chain there, and accumulate. And so where we can make steps or take those steps to reduce the harm, whether it's to young children, to developing fetuses, I think it's the responsible thing to do.
Senator Obama said mercury levels lead to serious developmental problems in children, as well as problems affecting vision, motor skills, blood pressure, and fertility in adults. Senator Murkowski says banning mercury is also good for Alaska, since it can be carried in fish. She says Alaska never had a contamination problem, but, quote, we want to keep it that way. She says halibut is an example. Alaska doesn't have a mercury problem with its halibut stocks.
But in other halibut that you see in other parts of the world, it is an issue. And so we try to say, well, Alaska's halibut is different. But it's tough for the consumer to appreciate that. Halibut in Alaska or Atlantic, they're not really paying that close attention.
She says that the ban is in Alaska's best interest for that reason alone and for the rest of the world by reducing mercury's presence in the environment. The bill sets up a ban on mercury exports beginning in 2013 and forbids its sale for commercial reasons from the U.S. government's stockpile of mercury. The federal government has awarded the state a 3-year grant to help prevent suicide among young Alaskans. The most recent data available says Alaskans between 15 and 24 commit suicide at 3 times the national average. Diane Casto is the manager of the Prevention and Early Intervention Services. She says young Native males are at the highest risk. While they make up less than 20% of the population, they account for 60% of the suicides.
One other group that we are noticing through the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which is a survey that is given out every other year through school districts, is that we have an increase among our 10th grade, 10th, 11th grade girls in areas of suicidal ideations and depression. So that's another area we want to keep an eye on. If that's starting to creep up, then we want to catch it before it goes any further.
Kessler says the grant will provide $500,000 for each of the next 3 years, adding an additional 50% to state appropriations and grants available for suicide prevention programs. And she said instead of funding startup programs that may not survive after the grant money is exhausted, the grant will be used to improve regional and local policies and practices that can continue.
we're going to try to build kind of a regional structure through regional suicide prevention teams and have the regions and the communities in those regions really look at their own community, at their own issues, at the risk factors, the protective factors. You know, what do we think is happening in our area, and how can we start changing what's happening in with our young people regarding suicide, regarding depression, regarding alcohol use, which is very closely associated with suicide rates.
She says the communities and regions will drive the changes that the grant will help identify. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the village of Klukwan achieves an important goal, their own basketball gym.
We're all about wellness and healing, and this village has taken that quite seriously.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell is in Unalaska this week to speak with residents about local and statewide issues and to learn more about the community. He answered questions and listened to concerns during a community meeting and a high school assembly. KUCB's Ann Hillman reports.
When Unalaskans met with Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell this week, they had some specific topics on their mind: energy problems, the governor, and the economy. They wanted to know how the government planned on helping villages in times of crisis, like last year's fuel shortage in Nikolski, or this year's economic troubles in ADAC.
Well, there are lots of things that the state is doing to help small communities, like municipal revenue sharing has been reinstituted by this governor. The renewable energy grants are available to communities. Low-income weatherization funds are available. There are just a myriad of ways that the state government is working to help local communities.
He said the only thing the state can do if situations are extreme is to declare an emergency and call in the National Guard, though he said he hopes that never happens. Many questions focused on the generally high cost of energy. Parnell said the Alaska Energy Authority is developing short, mid, and long-term energy plans to be released this December that will focus on that issue. Community members also asked how the government is being run now that Governor Sarah Palin is on the campaign trail with Republican presidential nominee John McCain.
She's still governing day by day. I mean, if anybody knows her, they'll know that she emails at 3 and 4 and 5 in the morning. And then various times throughout the day, she's in constant communication with her chief of staff. Each of her commissioners has access to her when they need it. I hear from her regularly.
Parnell says his duties have remained mostly the same since she left the state, though he has to give more speeches than before. If Palin's bid for the vice presidency is successful, Parnell told a group of high schoolers he's ready to lead the state.
We're different people, so we will, you know, execute differently. We will maybe talk a little differently. We'll act a little differently. But she and I see eye to eye on some key issues. Like, for instance, her number one priority for our state right now is energy and making sure that we can have lower energy costs for Alaskans.
Despite the national spotlight shining on Troopergate and on Senator Ted Stevens' corruption trial, Parnell says Palin has improved the image of Alaska nationwide.
For the national media to put her under a microscope in this presidential and vice presidential campaign, it's to be expected that not everything will be pleasant to look at. But frankly, this is the first time where Alaska is on the tip of everybody's tongue in the national media, and it's 98% positive. America doesn't view Alaska anymore as being on that Good Morning America map somewhere down by Hawaii. They know where we are.
He said his 98% statistic is based on comments from his friends in the lower 48. Other community members' concerns focused on the negative economic impacts of limited ferry service and state services in the region and the inadequacies of Unalaska's short runway. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Governor Sarah Palin's rural advisor, Rhonda McBride, has announced she's stepping down. She says more Alaska Native voices are needed in the governor's office. McBride has been in the position for about 10 months. She announced her intention to leave in an email to several Native leaders. McBride told APRN's Lori Townsend that given the current crisis in rural Alaska, appointing a Native to the rural advisor position is especially important.
With rural Alaska facing things you know, the very breakdown of rural Alaska in some communities that are becoming so small that they are having trouble carrying on the basic functions of government. And I think you need someone who, you know, is an Alaska native, who has that passion, that credibility, that authenticity. And not to say that I'm not passionate, but I think an Alaska native speaking out on a lot of these issues, you know, might be more effective. The other thing, too, that strikes me is that in the course of my job, I met many Alaska Natives who struck me as more qualified than myself to do this job, especially those that work in the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. You know, they are not only Alaska Native, but they have a real grasp of the issues that villages are struggling with. And I was often going to them for the answers. And I think that the Native community needs to have that person too, that person that they trust truly understands their lifestyle.
In the time that you were working in the capacity of Rural Affairs Advisor, did you get out to Bush, Alaska quite a bit? Did you travel to villages?
I did. I was very lucky. In fact, the Interior Regional Housing Authority this past summer invited me and a number of others from the head of the Denali Commission, George Canales, and Commissioner Emil Noddy from Commerce to travel on a flow trip down the Koyukuk, starting at Bettles, Evansville, and going all the way down to Galena, about 500 miles. And it was sort of on this trip that I sort of had my defining moment. Rose Ellis, who works from AFN, was talking to me about how much she enjoyed subsistence fishing and cutting fish. And we got to this point in the conversation and she said, "You don't cut fish, do you? You haven't been a subsistence fisher." And I said, "No, you know, I lived in Bethel and people were very kind to me and brought me fish all the time. So I never had to go out and subsist." And she said, "Imagine that, a rural advisor that has never caught a salmon." And the comment wasn't made in a mean way. It was just, "Oh." And I thought about that some more. And I said, "You know, the person that's in this position really has to have a part in that lifestyle."
What other kind of feedback did you get from people in the villages? Was it a good reception, mixed? Was there criticism? How was it when you were out there?
Now, I think, you know, Native leaders have treated me very well. But I think, you know, Albert Kukesh, who is co-chair of AFN, one of the first few weeks on the job, I was invited to a Bush caucus meeting. And Albert Kukesh said, "You know, I don't want you to take this personally, but we just don't have enough voices in the upper levels of state government, you know, particularly in the governor's office. And so you're taking one of those places. And I want you to know that. And not that I don't think that you have rural Alaska's interests at heart, but he says, you don't have the passion that comes from," and I'll paraphrase here, "being authentic, that is who you are, what your culture is." And I think people in the governor's office, you know, I don't think that there's any malintent. I think that they would never knowingly not care about rural Alaska. But to be able to learn about rural Alaska from a Native person is a difference in the quality of the information.
Linda McBride's last day as rural advisor will be October 23rd. She intends to return to her former job as a reporter for Channel 2 in Anchorage. Tlingit tribal members in the Native village of Klukwan celebrated the realization of a long-term goal over the weekend with the dedication of its new gymnasium and basketball court. John Hart reports from KHNS.
Clukwan Village Tribal Administrator John Brower said Saturday's celebration marked an important milestone.
Well, the gym is like a renewal thing because not many villages in Alaska don't have a gym. Basketball is a big thing in Native villages, and this was a thing that the community wanted. It's all community-driven, and the community tells us what to do, and we do it.
The road to actual use of the gym was longer than Brower had envisioned. Unexpected delays caused the postponement of its opening by nearly a year. Completion of the new gym is symbolic of the internal changes that members of the community are going through. The village council has been working on a strategic development plan since 2002. Part of that plan included construction of the gymnasium to bring the sport of basketball back to the village.
We're all about wellness and healing, and this village has taken that quite seriously. And they're going back to just who they really are and what's their spirits inside their bodies. And this is all part of it. Basketball is a major part of things in a Native village. And so this is going to do a major part of that renewal, that spiritual uplifting that they need and that they want to do.
For 27 years, the village has sponsored the Dick Hotch Memorial Basketball Tournament in Haines, 20 miles away. The 2009 tournament will be held in Clukwan.
And to bring the Dick Hotch tournament home here in February, that's a huge event. We no longer have to, you know, that's Clukwan's tournament. And we've always had to do it outside. Now we'll be able to do it here. And that's going to be a great, great day when we open the doors for that tournament.
With help from Diana Borough, I'm John Hunt in Haines.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Railroad Corporation, with daily rail service to Seward, Whittier, Anchorage, Talkeetna, Denali Park, and Fairbanks through mid-September. Information available at alaskarailroad.com. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
Snow cover in interior Alaska isn't keeping wildfire managers from trying to carry out prescribed burns. State and federal agencies have been burning brush and grasses to eliminate fuels available for future wildfires. Bureau of Land Management Alaska Fire Service spokesman Doug Stockdale says shallow snow cover does not totally halt prescribed burn operations.
Prescribed burns can take place depending on what the weather is doing at the time and how much snow is on the ground. Like when we're trying to do a grass burn, if the winds have blown the snow off of the area, we can sometimes get the grass to carry a fire, and it'll help reduce fuel in the spring or into the summer.
Stockdale says areas where trees and brush have been bulldozed into piles or windrows can also be ignited despite snow cover. Burns this month have already targeted brush in the Moose Creek area near North Pole, and the schedule calls for prescribed fires in the Donnelly Military Training Area south of Delta Junction. Residents on the Kuskokwim River were surprised by a quick freeze this week. The river was ice-free on Saturday, but overnight, big chunks of ice appeared, making driving conditions dangerous. Now the river is nearly bank-to-bank ice. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
It's a bone-chilling day. Not the kind of weather that makes for a comfortable ride in an open boat. Simon Lawrence just arrived in Bethel after boating down from his home village of Queethluck. Lawrence says he almost didn't make it.
I was trying to get a shortcut. Since I couldn't make it, I just went around the slough, the other slough. Too thick. Too much ice.
Queethluck is just 15 miles upriver from Bethel. As a hub community, many villagers come for essential services. Lawrence dodged ice chunks and broke through fresh glare ice to make a health appointment here. But after his harrowing trip down, he says he's cutting his business short and heading back home before the ice gets worse.
Some parts are clear and maybe inch thick. Dangerous, yeah, dangerous.
Apparently, he's not alone. About five boats of Queethluck residents met up and caravaned back home together. That was Monday afternoon. Less than 48 hours later, Bethel Search and Rescue issued a warning for boaters to stay off the river.
Boats, no, should not be in the boats out there at this time. There's no way that a boat can navigate out there right now.
Peter Achak is the president of Bethel Search and Rescue. He just completed an aerial survey of the river with support from the Alaska State Troopers. He says the river froze up in a hurry.
It's a lot more frozen than we had expected from the ground.
Achak says there's at least a thin layer of ice almost everywhere, but other portions of the river are still in transition.
The main channels where there's strong current, you know, that's the only places we've seen some prominent water and some ice flowing.
This time of year can be a dangerous one for those that try to travel by their own means. Now, bush plane is the only safe way to get from villages to the hub. A round-trip flight from Kwikluk runs about $150. Further villages can cost over $400. But Achak says the river still has some freezing to do before locals fire up their snow machines.
This time of the year, there's a lot of deep holes out there that can swallow up a machine and man.
Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The Alaska Forest Association opened its annual convention today in Anchorage. The industry is a shadow of what it was in the 1990s when large southeast mills provided more than 1,000 jobs and significant payrolls. But Executive Director Owen Graham says it's not all bad these days.
One of the positives we have is the Sea Alaska legislation was introduced. Right now, the Sea Alaska's operations are about a half or less than half of what they traditionally have been. If we can get that legislation passed, they'll have a tremendous increase in activity and employment. That would help a lot.
Juneau-based Sea Alaska is seeking congressional approval of a plan to select more logging land on Prince of Wales Island. Congressman Don Young and Senator Lisa Murkowski have introduced bills to advance that land transfer. Association members will also hear about the Forest Service 5-year timber management plan. Graham says the industry needs more trees for logging companies to cut and for mills to process.
So far, whether it's private timber or state timber or federal timber, the problem is not enough timber supply. Even with the markets being the way they are nationwide, our markets are still pretty good because we're one of the few places that has old growth timber that makes these specialty products that are still command a pretty good value. So we don't have problems with markets. We have a problem with getting enough timber to operate.
The Forest Association convention will also include discussion of the Tongass Timber Trust, a health insurance plan that serves the industry. Graham says it's healthy, but troubled by changes in the business.
Our health insurance program is working because we went self-insured and we have, you know, and fairly good claims, and we're going to be working on that plan to make sure we can go forward into the future, even though we don't have a large industry.
The association convention runs through Friday. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. Send us your thoughts. Go to aprn.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to tell us if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, John Hunt in Haines, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Duncan Moon. Have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.